gentlemen, good evening, and welcome to the first of this year's three lectures in what is remarkably the 56th successive series of Hamlin lectures. I should perhaps first introduce myself. I probably need more introduction than the speaker does. I'm Stephen Sedley, and I'm a member of the Board of Trustees. The Hamlin Trust exists for the single purpose of presenting this annual lecture series. It was set up under the will of Emma Hamlin, West Country solicitor's daughter, who died at the age of 80 in 1941, and left a fund to sponsor an annual lecture in memory of her father. Its stated objects are quite complex, but the bottom line is that the lectures are to be about our law and legal system from an international perspective. The first Hamlin lecture was delivered in 1949 by a newly appointed judge of the Court of Appeal named Denning. 49 years later, when I had the daunting privilege of delivering the 50th series, Lord Denning was still alive and in his 100th year. The lectures continue on their unbroken course with the 2005 series, of which tonight's is the first. Professor Geertie will be delivering the second next week in Durham, and the third the week after in Belfast. There's no need to book train tickets, however. Cambridge University Press will be publishing the full series of lectures in book form in the spring, and you can all join the queue at the bookshop instead. Conor Geertie is a graduate of University College Dublin and of Cambridge, where he went on to take his doctorate and to become a fellow of Emmanuel College. He also, although perhaps being now a barrister, he'd rather I didn't mention this, qualified as a solicitor in Ireland, and indeed came top of the Irish national exams. From Cambridge, he moved to a lectureship and then to a chair at King's College, London, and from King's he came to his present chair at the LSE as rousing director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. He also, miraculously, finds time to practice at the bar, and I believe even occasionally sees his wife and children. His publications and frequent radio appearances have been largely on topics associated with terrorism and civil liberties. Although, like me, he was not among those arguing during the 1980s and 90s for a Bill of Rights in mainland Britain, we both, I think, saw the enactment of the Human Rights Act as an opportunity to make at least this bit of the world a slightly better place. But the Human Rights Project has not been welcomed by a vocal segment of the media, and alongside its achievements, which are considerable, it plainly faces major obstacles, both in the United Kingdom and in the wider world. And this is Conor Geertie's topic for the 2005 Hamlin Lectures: Can Human Rights Survive? Tonight's aspect of the question is the crisis of authority, and I ask Conor Geertie to present his lecture.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Actually, nobody's mentioned that that solicitor thing for about 20 years, so my brother got 0.2% less than me. I remember that as a kind of example of how siblingly competitive I am. But when I had to become a barrister in England, I had to get myself struck off the Irish branch of solicitors, because though we are an independent country, it's still not accepted here that we are separate entirely. And so there was a large ad in the Irish Times saying, if anybody doth object to the striking off of Conor Geertie from the solicitor's role, be you advised that now is the time to move. And it really embarrassed my mother, because there wasn't any little asterisk, and my father indeed, there wasn't any little asterisk, this is because he's becoming a barrister, you know. And I never thought then, or even until very recently, and you've heard the kind of people who've given this lecture before, Lord Denning might actually be here, I think you'd never know, really, that I would say that I'm delighted that Miss Emma Warburton Hamlin of Torquay existed, because remarkably, at the age of 80, she she endowed this extraordinary lecture series, these extraordinary lectures over many years, which are daunting to follow, I can tell you, as an academic. And she did it because she wanted to further, by lectures or otherwise, among the common people of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the knowledge of the comparative jurisprudence and ethnology of the chief European countries, including the United Kingdom. And I'm really delighted to be doing this. I think it's an extraordinary thing that this woman, whom nobody knows much about, in honour of her father, who is a Justice of the Peace, should have done this. And I think it's terrific that it's been going on for so long. Now, this lecture is about this crisis of authority. And it's about 45 minutes or so 50 minutes maybe, I'm afraid. But I'm not supposed to tell you, but there is a drink afterwards. And I want to start by paying tribute to to our elected representatives. It's not really germane to today, but I think we should notice it. In their resistance to the demands of the police yesterday, demands which were relayed to the wider world by the helpful Prime Minister, these men and women have shown us human rights in action. And now, we don't know the names or the faces of those who would have been arrested and detained for 3 months. Almost certainly, they would not have resembled in class, in ethnicity, in social standing, the vast majority of the MPs who voted last night. But these nameless people have nevertheless been protected. Their liberty, their families, their jobs, saved from the trauma of sudden long-term removal from society. Of course, some of them might be these hypothetical persons involved in the commission of offences. Of course, they should be arrested. But we're not sure, and many people might have disappeared out of society for 3 months. The police have been reminded that an arrest should come towards the end rather than at the start of an investigative process. Scarcely credible. We used to teach that the arrest was what you did before you brought charges, not what you did before you began the investigation. And the police spokesman in number 10 is, I hope, feeling just a little bit chastened. This is an example of human rights in action. So it's been a great day yesterday for the human rights people, many of whom I see here this evening. I see Shami Chakrabarti's here a bit further down there with Rabinder Singh. When I want to hear from Shami, I don't ring her up. I just turn on the TV, really. You know. And I think she's been a living embodiment of human rights as she's embarrassed and cajoled Conservative Party members into voting for a civil liberties proposal, which is some feat. But my subject, the first of these three Hamlin lectures, is not terrorism, national security, or any of those issues that have so preoccupied us in recent days. These come later in my third lecture in Belfast. Here I am concerned with something more abstract, I'm afraid, perhaps trickier to follow, I'm afraid, than an attack on our illiberal terror laws or an analysis of this or that case. But it's very important nonetheless. I think it goes to the very roots of our subject. It is about the foundations from which all else flows. It's about the basis of authority of human rights. You know, I've just been talking about this great human rights victory. But what does it mean to believe in the right to liberty, or indeed in any other human right for that matter? To work properly, this language of human rights does seem to need to be based on truth, on being right, on knowing we are right. The very term human rights is a strong one. It's epistemologically confident. It's assured ethically. It carries with it a promise to the hearer to cut through the noise of assertion and counter-assertion, of cultural practices and of relativist values, and to deliver truth. To work its moral magic, human rights needs to exude this kind of certainty, this old-fashioned clarity. To say I have a right to something is not to suggest something, it is to state it. It is not to ask, it is to demand. Now, those of us here who are part of what sometimes people call the human rights community do come across a bit smug in contrast to the rest of society, don't we? We know the right answers. We have special access to the truth, quite unlike my colleague and friend, Professor Christopher Greenwood, down the corner, whom I'm delighted to see present to take yet more punishment from me in a public forum. Chair, under no circumstances are questions from Professor Greenwood to be accepted. I'm committed to freedom of expression, but there are limits. This is not ordinary politics, we say, this human rights stuff. This is morality. This is about right and wrong. And we know, even if mere mortals don't, which is right and which is wrong. Not as a matter of policy, but as a statement of truth. Now, this is not how most of politics works. Indeed, it's not how the world works anymore. Uncertainty, rather than certainty, is, perhaps more than anything else, the key defining feature of our culture today. So it's this mismatch between the apparent certainty of our human rights claims and the radical uncertainty of the culture in which they are made that gives rise to my lecture's title, The Crisis of Authority. This mismatch, certainty in a world of uncertainty. If the idea of human rights amounts to, as my colleague Francesca Klug, whom I'm delighted to see here as well, amounts to, as Francesca's put it, a set of values for a godless age, then their custodians face a tougher task today than perhaps their enthusiasm allows them to realize. Are human rights to be just whatever feels right? Is it enough to assert the importance of equal treatment or equality of respect as the basis of human rights, but then avoid discussion of where these ideas come from? Why not hurt our neighbor? Grab all we can from a passing stranger? Walk past the hungry homeless with unmoved heart? Our various answers to this: truth, we know right from wrong, we are under a moral obligation, all this sort of stuff seems to come from another age. It's like calling Radio 4 the home service, or going around the place saying that the Guardian is the Manchester Guardian, or the radio is the wireless. Their very deployment seems to date the user. Moral obligation, right and wrong, the eyes glaze over. The great utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who, if he were alive today, would be a brilliant Melanie Phillips type Daily Mail columnist on the subject of human rights, he condemned natural rights as nonsense on stilts. But stilts are a sort of support, a foundation for something, even if a flimsy one. Perhaps a modern day, postmodern Bentham would deride our subject as nonsense without stilts. Now, Francesca talked about values for a godless age, and contrast the situation of the human rights activist with that of a similar kind of person, the religious believer. I know it's offensive to say to human rights people they're like that, but there's similarities. Now, Jürgen Habermas, it's the Hamlin Lectures, I have to mention, has remarked of religious beliefs, and this is a quote from Jürgen Habermas, that they require striking cognitive dissonances, since, as he puts it, the complex life circumstances in modern pluralistic societies are normatively compatible only with a strict universalism in which the same respect is demanded of everybody, be they Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, believer or non-believer. What he's saying there, of course, is that the various truths that each religion has are self-evidently in difficulty in a society devoted to that kind of pluralism. But in comparison with believers in human rights, religious followers have it actually rather easy. Often they are not from modern pluralistic societies at all, and so they don't have any of this Habermas-inspired doubt. Even if they live in a pluralist culture, they have many bulwarks against crisis available to them. The confidence of a way of life that has been around for centuries. The support of a community of believers They go every week to remind themselves that they're not alone. The leadership of decisive figures, perhaps even a structure of authority that protects the mind from external challenge. Above all, what they have, confidence in some kind of God or spirit that speaks directly to the situation of their followers, both individually and collectively. For some exceptionally lucky believers, there is even the bonus of eternal life at some point in the post-future. Now, think about us, the human rights believers. They are lonely and vulnerable in comparison. They seek heaven on earth and for all, not just or even mainly for themselves or the chosen few. It is firmly within, quoting Habermas again, the complex life circumstances in modern pluralistic societies that they must ply their trade. They're stuck in pluralist society. They cannot thrive outside it. To the extent that human rights instincts are to be found in the world of certainty, outside pluralism, where the religious believers are still at home, then it's as a benign branch of this or that religious belief that they function. Human rights needs pluralist society, but pluralism's shelter for human rights, and this is one of the themes of the lecture, leaks with doubt. In a place where everything is true, nothing can be really true. Human rights people are stuck, required without the support of many symbols to practice their beliefs in exactly those places, developed modern societies, where belief in anything as being true is hard enough, and belief in something moral, apparently rooted in human nature, is hardest of all. They are the disciples of an idea rather than a holy text, although they do grab hold of the Universal Declaration. Mainly it's an idea. They don't have a holy, much less a divine person, and the closest they get to congregational worship is the occasional drinks party after an event like this. They're usually too polite for the solidarity that comes from public protest. There's nothing like breaking a few windows to bond you. I'm making an allusion to the suffragettes, of course, not inciting any violence. I'm not sure yet whether that's a criminal offence. But still, despite all this nonsense without stilts, human rights seems to bloom, this nonsense without stilts. It's like some kind of mysterious plant that can thrive only when not rooted firmly in the soil. Human rights as an idea defies its apparent shallowness, and like such a plant, goes from strength to strength. The shallower, the better. The more superficial, the better. The plethora of international, regional, and legal instruments that embed the term in various codes of law has been one of the most remarkable features of the legal developments over the past 60 years. Almost nowhere is now without its human rights charter, its set of guarantees of fundamental freedoms. And away from the law, much contemporary political activity is suffused with the language of rights. It is as though not to assert a right to what one desires is to make a fatal admission as to its unimportance. Everybody is clamoring to get on the rights bandwagon. With the end of the Cold War and the consequent failure of socialism to maintain, and I always put in brackets here, for the time being at least, chasing the socialist chimera, not quite dead yet, etc. But let's face it, for now, the consequent failure of socialism to maintain an ideological challenge to capitalism, human rights, a creature of capitalism, it's true, but human rights has stepped into the breach. It has sought, with some success, to hold back the tide of the market and of unmediated self-interest, despite these forces being driven forward by the strong winds of, and the strong and inevitable winds of globalization. At times, it has seemed that it has been only this barely rooted, shallow plant that has lain between us and capitalist anarchy. Slightly overstate the point. Or, and possibly not to overstate the point, as we saw last night, a human rights culture standing between us and a prime ministerial police state. Not one yet in place, or the prime minister might burst in to reprimand me, but one that might be coming if we don't act, and we did act. So human rights have never had it so good. Why ask, can human rights survive? Would it not be better to question less and act more? Not reflect on philosophical ideas like foundations and so on, but just continue to use the term to do good work in a world in which goodness is in short supply, and where it's a waste of effort to spend a lot of time trying to explain what goodness actually means. Stop thinking and get doing. There's a lot to be said for that. Human rights scholarship is, above all, activist scholarship. Human rights advocates are very practical in their approach to the world. But ignoring the big picture carries risks. At the moment, the term human rights has ethical cachet. It enjoys moral power. As a shorthand description of how we want to improve the world, it works very well. But it's not guaranteed to do so all the time. We are trading on the force that was put into this term by past generations. We are spending the bank account. First those who saw it as a branch of religion, and then those in the modern era who gave it its secular rationalist twist. Residues of commitment to both of these visions in the world remain in our pluralist society. We haven't given up totally on religion, we haven't given up totally on reason. Because of this, the idea of human rights, half pre-modern, half modern, continues to enjoy a warm reception. It still works because of our memory of what we were. But as postmodern uncertainty embeds itself more deeply in our culture, as our memory of religious and enlightenment times fades, so our commitment to this benign relic of both can be expected to begin to recede. Without a reworking of what the term means today, designed to give it a contemporary intellectual confidence, some theoretical zest, then the time might come, and it may not be that far away, when firing the human rights argument will be greeted neither with warmth nor dismay, but rather with blank indifference, or, which is worse, mute incomprehension. It could be our children. Stephen was mentioning the kids, and I see Diane's here, so they're probably goodness knows where, but our children, no, they're being well looked after. Our children might say, what can that term mean? Is it not merely of historical interest these days? Part of what we used to be rather than what we have become? Or worse still, the term might be known, but have taken a different shape, means something else. Oh, human rights, yeah, they're fine, but they're not for everybody, you know, they're just for us. Or worse, beating that guy up in that way, that's fine, that's compatible with his human rights. I've got this judicial warrant. Now, there are signs afoot that something like this is already underway. The crystallization in law of the idea of human rights is without doubt a sure sign of success. It's great. All ideas aspire to grow up to be part of a legal code, enforced by judges and police. But if we don't really know what human rights is about, if we don't have a confident understanding of what it means, the dangerous side effects of this victory can outweigh the benefits. The triumph of legal form over substance. The subjugation of the liberationist tendencies in human rights to the demands and interests of the already powerful. The strengthening of anti-democratic elements in society to the detriment of the public interest. This crisis of legalism is the subject of my second lecture in Durham and in the book, which I'm delighted to hear you've been encouraged already to buy, the unwritten as yet book. So Cambridge University Press, sorry, it's on the way. In my third Hamlin lecture, which is in Belfast in the following week, I look at how the lack of clarity of understanding in the term of human rights has weakened its resistance to abuse by national power. How, in some eyes, not in everybody's, in some eyes, it has become a tool of foreign policy, sanctioning, in the minds of some, legitimizing even, exactly those kinds of abuses of rights, torture, illegal neocolonial militarism, that, if our subject meant anything at all, it should surely, obviously, rule out. Now, that's the lecture. It's called A Crisis of Scarce Resources, the Belfast one, because I see the current war on terror, to use a phrase not frequently used in this country, in fairness to the authorities, as a dismal harbinger of an even greater war over natural resources. That the West looks as though we might, despite our better selves, be getting ready to fight. And we want to fight it. We want to grab the world's resources whilst maintaining our status as a human rights respecting culture. Now, these are for future lectures. Today, I'm trying to see whether I can resolve this crisis of authority, whether we can construct foundations for human rights that are not nonsensical, support systems that can defend the phrase not by the simple invocation of past glories, but in terms that ring true today, that run with rather than against the grain of contemporary assumptions about what it means to be right and wrong, that allow us to name abuses of human rights when we see them, even when they're done in the name of human rights. So that's the agenda. This task is made tougher by the unpalatable realization that it's very hard to pin down exactly when this supposed golden age of human rights was supposed to have existed. The subject has never been lucky in its intellectual apologists. Its heroes are not good at transcending their particular moment and speaking to us clearly today. The Greeks knew, for example, all about justice, natural justice, fairness, and the like, but they didn't have words to describe the notion of a subjective right, of a set of entitlements invested in a person on simple account of their humanity. We can't go back to them. Often in contemporary discourse we can, but not here. The Roman Catholic Church embraced the concept of natural law with enthusiasm and saw in it a variety of propositions that could be taken to be indelibly true. But in its initial form, and for centuries afterwards, this notion of objective right did not stray into subjective territory. A right was in the air, not in the bodies walking in the earth beneath. Now, with its emphasis on individuality, we owe a lot to the Protestant Reformation, which introduced this subject, this subjective, into the process. When these kinds of individual rights did emerge, however, their manifestly Christian basis made them an uncertain ally in our contemporary, very secular culture. And other faiths and religious systems established or flourishing around the same time as Christianity, they had many ideas of duty, fellowship, solidarity, and stuff like that. But it would be stretching things too far. Sometimes we do as a kind of token of ecumenical zeal. But it would be stretching things too far to say that they have any kind of refined concept of a set of what we would understand today to be individually based human rights. So that particular set of historical narratives is not terrific at speaking to us today, at giving us something for authority. And unfortunately, nor are the people we identify with the subject more than any. The people who, well, they were fantasists about human nature, they were hanging about in the 17th and 18th centuries, and they seized an initiative which has never quite been surrendered: Locke, Hobbes, and Rousseau. The foundations they put down are not the kind that we can recover and put to effective support today. The English tradition, epitomized by Hobbes and Locke, sees the individual as the bearer of pre-political rights, with government a necessary but unpleasant antidote to anarchy. Rousseau saw things exactly the other way around. Freedom needed to be achieved rather than surrendered. It flowed out of, rather than preceded, authority. The authority of the general will of the people expressed through law. Now, why do these guys matter? Because each of them underpinned successful revolution. And if you think ideas matter, forget it. You need to be on the right side in a war. And if the war produces a victory that lasts for centuries, you'll be famous. And, of course, we had the violent revolution in England in 1688, and in France, and what became the United States a century later. But the human rights bit in Locke soon lost out to its power to government corollary, manifest still in this country as the sovereignty of Parliament, albeit laced with a kind of liberal individualism that is grumpy about official power and still nostalgic for this mythical pre-political age. Sort of current Conservative Party in a way. You know, we want sovereignty of Parliament, but we hate sort of the individual being interfered with. That sums up the Lockean legacy. For its part, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen was to go down in a hail of fire not only at Waterloo, but also, speaking metaphorically, before the scorching critique of that triad of giants, Bentham, I've already mentioned, Marx, and Edmund Burke, a fellow Irishman. A cheap national point, wholly irrelevant. Wonder how he did in his solicitor's exam, Steve. Rousseau's unfortunate ramble about forcing people to be free was dubious when it was written, and it's not been improved by the horrors that have been done in the name of compulsory freedom. A great friend of mine whom I sent this to wrote back an email about an hour ago saying, I should acknowledge the infringements of human rights committed by socialist governments, and I promised to, and now I will say I did. He didn't like the next bit. As for America, it may have kept more of Locke than Britain, but its sweeping declaration of independence, magnificent in its formulation, quickly plummeted via a much narrower constitutional Bill of Rights into a provincial legalism from which that culture has yet to emerge. I talk about this, what I call disastrous legalization of American rights, in my second lecture, where I talk about this thing called the crisis of legalism. So we can see, though, that even at its heyday, the human rights idea did not deliver leadership that would appeal today. The religious speak in a way we don't now generally recognize as persuasive. And the Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau ideas about states of nature, noble savages, and the like seem contrived and old-fashioned, arguing for a truth that, even at its pinnacle, was never more than hypothetical. Not surprisingly, the subject of human rights went into a sharp decline in the 19th century. And though its legal form was salvaged and given international standing after the Second World War, its philosophical underpinnings have never quite recovered to the same extent. The crisis of authority. It's been seen off philosophically, recovered legally and politically, but the philosophy hasn't come in to support the law and the politics. If it was a combination of big ideas, democracy, socialism, nationalism, and big thinkers, Bentham, Burke, and Marx, that weakened the human rights fighter in the ring, forced that fighter against the ropes in the 19th century, it was Charles Darwin who delivered the devastating knockout blow. His was the attack that has made the philosophical recovery to match the legal renaissance of the last 60 years so difficult to bring about. Now you might be surprised. Darwin is an eccentric figure, hardly a human rights philosopher. His fame does not obviously fit the narrative. I'm going to argue that human rights needs to confront the challenge of Darwin and what has followed from Darwin. In its buckling before his model of the world lie the seeds of the idea's second coming, as I would argue. So first, the buckling before the arguments of Darwin, and second, at the end, the second coming. My route into Darwin is to say this. Let's reflect together, what does this idea of human rights entail? Think about it. The very way we express this, the idea of human rights, suggests that logically speaking, human rights, as a subject, depends above all on thought. You might say, obviously, but not obviously. It's not something that emerges from our bodies as a feeling or an emotion. It's not the same as love, hate, anger, or even a sense of unfairness. Kids can see unfairness, but they're not so quick to see a right to something. The concept of human rights needs brain power to drive it, to explain what it involves, to tell us what, as a result, we ought to do. It has more work to do in this regard even than ideas like justice and fairness, which I think more readily come from our gut to our brains to be processed out. Its fertile breeding ground is the mind, not the heart. Now, this is why human rights have thrived in the modern era. The era initiated by Descartes, the sharp distinction drawn between the mind on the one hand and the body on the other, with a strong emphasis on the overarching importance of the mind. We know the story. Immanuel Kant is the patron saint of these secular celebrators of brain power, and he's the godfather of human rights. But it was Pascal who produced, I think, the most revealing quote, famously claiming, "Thought constitutes the greatest of humanity," and then said, "The human being is just a reed, the weakest thing in nature, but it is a thinking reed. So our whole dignity consists of thought. That's what we should rely on. Let us work at thinking well. That is the basis of morality." Note the reference to human dignity here, the notion believed by many to be what human rights is all about. And on this view of the world, it's only through careful thinking that we can work out what to do to foster dignity. And when we have done that, human rights are merely a fairly straightforward next step in the argument. The entitlements enjoyed by other persons that flow from what our mind tells us is our moral obligation towards them. Now, this prioritization of the mind is essential to the construction of the idea of human rights. That's what I'm saying. It has the handy consequence of affirming our uniqueness, the uniqueness of humanity. Something these great thinkers were very keen to do. We're different, we're special. That's what we say as human rights people as well. Look at that first word, human. We have a kind of speciistic approach. Suits us. Now, this specialness has not gone unchallenged in the past. Great Scottish philosopher, writer David Hume called reason the slave of the emotions. Well, I didn't like that. These brain boxes who turned their own skill into the most important form of reality. But it was Darwin, on my argument, whose breakthroughs on evolution rendered the mind-body distinction impossible to maintain and made the position of human rights so precarious as a result. Darwin made it plausible, quoting a guy called Tom Gray, who wrote a great article on Oliver Wendell Holmes. Darwin made it plausible to think of mental capacities as evolved functions of natural organisms arising from similar forms of animal behavior as a result of their survival-promoting tendencies. Darwin took our minds out of some unique spiritual ether, some soul, some cloud, and put it back in our bodies. For how could a ghostly mind be linked to the material mind through the bodily machine that it somehow haunts? The mind doesn't work. We are, after Darwin, as Nietzsche famously put it, just clever animals, differing from the rest only in our greater capacity to re-describe and recreate ourselves. Now, I'll come round with you to the human rights implications of this. Big picture point. Truth can no longer be found by examining the contents of our minds and reporting back discoveries like some kind of explorer. There's nothing to report back because there's nothing to find. And there's nothing to find because there's nothing there. Nothing, that is, apart from the bits and pieces of the organism or material into which we have, over multiples of generations, evolved. Truth like God a generation earlier, was dead. Now, you might think, maybe the way we use words saves the day, and people tried that for a bit. But language is not a medium taking messages from the body out or the world in. Language is not an errand boy of some truth king lurking eerily in the heavens, in nature, or in our soul. Language is a subset of communication, a highly specialized form, but a subset nevertheless. Something that animals do at some basic level or other. Thoughts are no longer things beyond words, reported to us by words. Thoughts are tied up with, made real by the words themselves. Now, where does human rights fit in all this? After Darwin and the philosophers who built on his work, thought has become a part of language. And language is a part of communication. What matters now is not what is said, but what is understood. Thinking has taken a practical turn. As the great American judge Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, nearly as old as Lord Denning, in fact older when he retired from the bench, just in 90. He said this, philosophy, as a fellow once said to me, is only thinking. Thinking is an instrument of adjustment to the conditions of life. What matters is what happens. And just alluding to a great, fantastic thinker who's a foundational in all of this, Charles Saunders Peirce, thinking is no longer to be conceived as something distinct from practice. It simply is practice or activity in its deliberative or reflective aspect. As Holmes put it, and we're ending the sort of complicated bit, I hope. Holmes put it like this, every idea is an incitement. It offers itself for belief, and if believed, is acted on. So get out of your mind the idea that there's thoughts out there that we grab, with language or otherwise. Now remember though, human rights depends on thinking. We can now see that thinking, to be action, needs talk. Or at least communication. And that requires agreement on meaning. To say that an organism is a language user, quoting now Richard Rorty, is just to say, reflect on this, is just to say that the pairing off the marks and noises it makes with those we make will provide a useful tactic in predicting and controlling its future behavior. That's what language use is. To work this way, to make language work, and therefore I would say to make thinking work, because thinking is indelibly, integrally intertwined with talking, speaker and listener need to converge on passing theories from utterance to utterance. Some of you might notice the allusion to Davidson. But if the only truth we can know for sure, I know that's a tautology, is our contingent agreement on what certain sounds we call words mean, would this not seem greatly to diminish the apparent promise of our two words, human rights? They promise to tie themselves firmly to a better, because stronger, kind of truth, and what the post-Darwinian guys are telling us is that actually that truth doesn't exist. The best we can hope for is agreement between speaker and listener on what words mean. Passing theories from utterance to utterance. That's why there's a crisis of authority. Because this has seeped into our intellectual life. Consider, for example, current foundationalist thinking in human rights. The people who still say that human rights are in fact true. It's taken on a very strong rhetorical color in recent years. And this is entirely to be expected under this kind of pressure. They become exercises in persuasion rather than in revelation. It's more, you've got to believe this, rather than, here are my findings. This explains that theory of human rights as reflecting overlapping consensuses around the world about right behavior, popularized by John Rawls and then in human rights field, Jack Donnelly. It must be right because lots and lots of people say it. The originality of Amartya Sen's recent effort to establish elements of a theory of human rights, fantastic article in philosophy and public affairs hinges on not reporting what human rights makes us obliged to do, but hinges on discussion, influencing people, thinking about, talking about what you ought to do. Now, even the work of that doyen of human rights foundationers, to whom I take off my hat, a fantastic thinker, Ronald Dworkin, even Ronald Dworkin's thinking, I think, has taken a rhetorical turn in recent years. Those of us who were present at a stunning bravado performance at the British Institute of Human Rights will remember it was evangelical in its fervor, persuasive, moving in the direction of persuasion about the rightness of our values and away from the communication of human rights truth. Everybody is reacting to the contingency of language, even if they think they are immune from its effects. The name of today's philosophical game is talk, not truth. So where does that leave the term human rights? Get right to the core of it now. The easy answer would be to confine it exclusively to the legal sphere. To say that human rights can only mean the values encapsulated in documentary form in international, regional, and national legal agreements, as interpreted by decision makers, and at a later remove, where there's been a dispute, the courts. Truth is therefore delivered by the authority of the words in the papers, mediated through the judge's assessment of what the words mean. But this is a very narrow approach that fails to capture what many people perhaps most mean today when they refer to human rights. People's perception of human rights in opinion polls and so on is completely at variance with the rights they find in the schedules of the acts. So there's a mismatch there. The words can be made to do more work, to reach a wider shared meaning than can be reduced to legal form. On this account, we could say that human rights are a manifestation in law and language of the values that are embedded in our culture. They are an outward sign of, to quote Francesca again, Francesca Klug, values in our skeptical age. Human rights, or godless age, human rights flow from our values. They are not identical to those values. As Francesca Klug notes, they do not dictate what our values should be from some perch on a celestial cloud. And with values, the focal point is rightly debate and discussion, not declamation. Values fit with our time in a way that the apparent, but we can now see, misleading absolutism of human rights does not. So values drive the persuasive power in the language of human rights. But which values? Which values should drive the human rights words? How can we avoid the criticism that these are a purely Western and therefore entirely non-universalistic? This talk of values should put us on our guard. Is human rights just a way of imposing Western lifestyles on the world under cover of some babble about truth? We've heard a lot about the so-called cultural relativism of human rights, and this invocation of the idea of values might seem to support it. But this is where we go back to Darwin. Not for refutation, but for a kind of secular salvation. For there is some universalism out there which we can put into words that reaches further and wider than the liberal communities of the West. What are these special features of the clever animal the human is? Three come to mind. First, self-conscious, capable of critical reflection of itself and where it fits in the environment in which it finds itself. Second, it's aware of death, both generally and specifically with regard to itself. Thirdly, this animal is capable of a set of contradictory impulses, the import of which, because it is a self-conscious being, it understands. On the one hand, capacity for acts of compassion, hospitality and kindliness, on the other, cruelty, humiliation, callousness. Looked at from the victim's point of view, this ability to feel pain is shared with animals. it's not linguistic in the narrow sense of the term. It requires no words to make its case. Now, searching in an uncharacteristic way for essentials, the celebrated and I think fantastic philosopher Richard Rorty has written the following. There is something, he says, within human beings that deserves respect and protection quite independently of the language they speak. It suggests, he says, a non-linguistic ability. The ability to feel pain is what is important, and the differences in vocabulary are much less important. This is true, but does it follow that because pain is non-linguistic, it can have no language? Rorty thinks not. No language for the pain. Victims of cruelty do not have much in the way of a language, he says. There is no such thing as the voice of the oppressed or the language of the victims. I disagree. There is such a language. The language of human rights. A language that speaks for people and that manages, by forcing people to be visible to everyone, to allow them eventually to speak for themselves as well. It is a language that is genuinely universal. Cruelty is as real in Harare as it is in Hampstead. This is a language that goes beyond simply finding words for suffering. It is richer and deeper than this. Making real by putting into words, there's no such thing as reality, making real by putting into words ideas of hospitality, of kindliness, but above all, of compassion. Here is the word, compassion, that best captures the kind of act of concern for others that the term human rights has come to signify. Now, I owe this to Professor Oliver Davies, who wrote a brilliant Aquinas lecture last year on this. Compassion is not love, and compassion is not mercy. Compassion, quoting Martha Nussbaum, has a cognitive element, understanding the other, an affective element, feeling for the other, and a voluntarist element, doing something about the other. Now, Oliver Davies' quote is good here. There is something subversive, indiscriminate, and boundary-crossing about compassion. He's right. It is through the rallying power of compassion that we can use human rights to frame and mobilize responses to sufferings and to atrocities. Compassion is a universalistic disposition from which virtue flows, and the linguistic medium through which it expresses itself is the language of human rights, the Esperanto of the virtuous. The unconditional hospitality, Derrida's phrase, that flows from compassion is wider, richer, more enabling than mere tolerance. It's not the same as tolerance. It is about enjoying and enabling the other to thrive rather than simply bearing with him or her. It's much better than tolerance. There is much more here than mere forbearance from cruelty and humiliation, important though that restraint is. This human rights language asserts that we are all equal in view of our humanity, and that our dignity, rooted in wonder at the sheer brute fact of our achievement, demands that we, each of us, be given the chance to do the best we can, to thrive, to flourish, to do something with ourselves. This applies across the world as a way of describing what we all are, not an offshoot of the brain power of a few white male dead intellectuals. Just as we all want to avoid cruelty wherever we are from, so also each of us wants to do the best with our lives. Human rights is the term we use when we try to make a truth out of this insight by sharing it with others. It's our passing theory. Now, remembering Darwin, we should note that this is not necessarily a religious perspective at all. Quoting a book by Jack Mahoney coming out on human rights, the emergence of the human being, even as a matter of chance, in a blind cosmos, is a genuine cause for wonder. and the product of the human species in the course of evolution is something to be wondered at with something approaching awe or natural reverence. So our very root is awe and wonder at the fact that we are. Democracy is part of this human rights story because it's the best way we've found yet of reflecting our inherent equality in the political arena. Moral progress is measured by how seriously we work through the insight that we are all equal. How much of a chance we give to each of us to grow as we choose, even where the growing is not the kind of thing we choose to do. Freedom and respect for human rights involve at bottom a recognition of the contingency that is inherent in all our efforts to tie down words and ways of living. It's a rejection of right answers in search of the chance to develop as best we can. Pluralism becomes what human rights is all about, not a means for its subversion. Final section of the lecture, because this addresses a core part. Do we need the language of human rights for all of this? Theoretically, no. There's this school created by Rorty, liberal Arnus. We might say recognition of a common susceptibility to humiliation is the only social bond that we need, and that our sense of human solidarity is based on a sense of common danger, not a common possession of shared power. Now, on this view, the individual is united by just a susceptibility to pain. According to Rorty, quoting him again, the notion of inalienable human rights is no better and no worse a slogan than that of the obedience to the will of God. If you need it, take it. You don't have to have it. Human rights, according to Rorty, they're superstitions, contrivances put forward by the weak to protect themselves against the strong. Now, I want to reflect on this word, superstition. Human rights are superstitions. The phrase hinges on equality of respect, human rights, which I say is the linchpin of democracy. That's a liberal society for you. It is clear that this kind of liberal society cannot be taken for granted in the present age. It is under attack from various enemies. Economic power, fundamentalist religion, national chauvinism among them. The positive side to liberalism, the commitment to compassion over cruelty, to personal flourishing over public prejudice, is also more exposed than it has been since the pluralist worldview first grabbed our imagination and persuaded us of its truth. Our democratic and legal processes are already in severe danger of being captured by the rich, while our public culture is increasingly filled with a noise of demonizing rabble-rousers. What can liberal society fight back with? Religious words don't work anymore. Socialist talk is almost as tired. Arguments about rationally based moral obligations, they seem beside the point too. And those who would not even use the language of human rights, those who would regard human rights as unacceptable superstitions, what would they do? Well, I'll change the subject when human rights comes up, you know. I think this is going too far. Postmodern decency needs to grab help wherever it can find it, without being too picky about its origins. So this is my kind of point. In this current age of doubt, with cruelty abundant in the gaps in our culture left by the abandonment of all our truths, and with the retreat of our soldiers of certainty swelling into a panic stampede, we've reached the point where, we should now admit, humankind simply cannot cope with too much unreality. We need truths, even if we have to make them up. It is not enough to leave everything to sentiment. Our better selves need more help than a few good books, a good movie, and a capacity to dodge unpleasant conversations. Sentiment isn't enough. Our culture is simply not up to jettisoning so much of the past while holding out such intangible and unsupported hope for the future. There's another point. If the good guys give up on the language of human rights, then others, less principled, differently motivated, will fill the words with a bleaker kind of meaning, ridiculing their preposterous breadth, maybe, putting the words at the service of the rich, or using the term to justify killing foreigners with differently coloured skin. The phrase human rights will not disappear if over-scrupulous liberals refuse to have anything to do with it. The words exist. They can be made to do good work. The true pragmatist would embrace the phrase and make it work, not wander from the battlefield of meaning with intellectual purity intact, but honour in shreds. Alistair MacIntyre, distinguished philosopher, may have been right, that naturally human rights are fictions. Much of the power of modern philosophical work has lain in the exposure of fictions. MacIntyre puts it like this very well: unmasking the unacknowledged motives of arbitrary will and desire which sustain the moral masks of modernity is one of the most characteristic modern of activities. Unmasking the self. Showing how many layers are not truly us, but are products of our society, culture, structures. I think the time has come for some strategic remasking. I think MacIntyre was wrong to hanker after a now impossible Aristotelian virtue, Benedict, the return of a Benedict. But he was right that something needs to be done. Remembering and updating Voltaire's remark, I'm very grateful to Martin Loughlin for a lot of help and for this as well, if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. I think that something that needs to be done now is the construction of a remasked self. Someone who knows the contingency of language, who knows the limitations it imposes on the search for truth, knows the uncertainty of all claims to knowledge, knows that there is no core self, but rather layers of accidentally accrued identity, but who nevertheless embraces goodness and dignity and right and wrong as words that, despite everything, work to make the world a better place. And it is the whole world that we have in mind, not just the overdeveloped Western bits of it. The term human rights, therefore, in conclusion, is the phrase we use when we are trying to describe decency in our post-philosophical world. It provides a link with the better parts of our past while guiding us to the finer features of our future. To paraphrase Oliver Wendell Holmes, this is the kind of thinking that works. It gives pithy expression to our feeling that there should be less cruelty, and is a handy way of saying what many of us feel, that everybody should be given a chance to do the best in life that they can, no matter where they live or what their version of a successful life would entail. And if we can agree on this meaning, and we can focus it on individuals, then we can spot bad faith. The guy who wants to kill a community so as to secure its human rights. There's a bit here about a professor at Harvard, but I'm becoming obsessed by him, but never mind. The professor who feels a little bit of roughing up is necessary to protect human rights. So I end by returning to this word superstition I asked you to think about. Richard Rorty's word. Superstition is not the same as fiction. Of course human rights are a superstition. There can be nothing else in the world of language that the term is forced to inhabit. Big deal. But a superstition is not necessarily a myth, and it is certainly not bound to be a lie. Superstition might be true. A mask can hide a face, but it may be an exact resemblance to what is underneath. We just don't know. All we can be sure of is that just because we have made something up, it does not necessarily follow that out there, beyond words, it is not true. Here's a few lines by a fantastic Australian poet, Les Murray. The poem's called The Meaning of Existence. Everything except language knows the meaning of existence. trees, planets, rivers, time, know nothing else. They express it moment by moment as the universe. Even this fool of a body lives it in part, and would have full dignity within it, but for the ignorant freedom of my talking mind. Thank you very much.
Let's start again. We have about 15 minutes for questions. Connor, I hope, has recovered sufficiently to answer them. There's a roving microphone, so when I point to you, please wait for it to come. What I'm going to say next applies to everybody except, I think, Professor Greenwood, who is probably entitled to a full right of reply after a savage attack upon him in the early part of the lecture. Apart from him, a question consists of a single sentence with a question mark at the end, and I may intervene to remind people of that if necessary. The lady at the back there.
Thank you. If this is a godless society, then where does the jihad war and the war on terrorism that we hear so much about fit in, and where are we going to?
I'm going to take a couple more and then ask Connor to deal with them all. I'm sorry that a large part of the audience isn't here. It's in an adjacent room operated by video link, but I'll make sure that the questions are recycled before Connor answers them. Yes, who's next? Somebody at the top.
Why this obsession with objectivity? And placing ourselves outside of reality.
My question is, if you see communication as a way of forging a reality, and with the past that we have in human rights, in creating a positive link to the future of human rights, what would be the key actors, such as media or education? Who do you see taking a leading role?
I'll ask Connor to roll those three questions up into one, if he can.
Am I allowed more than one sentence?
You're allowed two sentences.
Two sentences.
And then to respond to them, then we'll come back to more questions.
I was asked about the jihad war on terrorism, semicolon. That'll be the subject of my third Hamlin lecture. They're all going to be on the Centre for the Study of Human Rights website, and that's because I do that in Belfast, and I devoted the third lecture is very much about that. So I can't sort of give a preview of that just now, but I do address it. It's a huge challenge. The questions can be magnificently economical. I guess I thought that human rights depended on this culture of reliance on objective truth. And I tried to reconfigure it in a way which meant it was less reliant on something which people didn't care about so much these days. On, second sentence, communicating, I think that's a really interesting one. I think just a couple of points on who does the work for other people, who does the work in kind of creating this, what I would now happily call a human rights culture, which I've never understood until I thought about this. A couple of points. The MPs did it yesterday. Gareth Pearce, writing in The Guardian in a most influential article, did it yesterday. The people who went to the trouble of organising these various opinion polls did it yesterday. The students who have meetings do it. The people who meet in pubs to talk about it do it. The people who engage some of their neighbours and try and get the neighbours to imagine what it's like to be the potential victim of these powers do it. the tragic consequence of the shooting dead of that poor Brazilian, Mendes, it was that a lot of people began to think, my goodness, it could happen to me. He wasn't one of the guys who should be shot, and my goodness, Brazilians look a bit like me. So a lot of it is cross community engagement and getting people to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. On Friday, the House of Lords did it, and a judgment indirectly upholding one of Stephen's Court of Appeal judgments, saying, thankfully, because Parliament gave them the chance, that you can't have a human rights culture in which asylum seekers are starving on the streets of London, in the streets of Britain. That's a huge thing. And they won 5-0, and a new kind of common sense is that you can't starve people within the country to frighten people who have not yet come from coming. So there's a multiplicity of actors, and small actions by a myriad of people create opportunities for that kind of social change. One last one is back to the jihad point. When that first detention without trial in Belmarsh came in, almost nobody took the view that it was very wrong. And it was kind of eccentric in the autumn of 2001 to say this was monstrous. And then there was a report by Lord Newton, a former Conservative cabinet minister, a Privy Councillor's review, which reviewed the whole thing and actually said this detention of non-nationals without trial is outrageous. And by the time it got to the House of Lords on the 16th of December last year, pretty well everybody agreed it was. And that's a fascinating example of how multiple actors can actually affect the change that I'm describing. So the answer is lots of them, depending on context.
I'd like to hear your comments about some relationship between this crisis of authority and the issues to reform the United Nations machinery of human rights, the Commission of Human Rights, and etc. in multilateral international organizations. And second, if the erosion of humanitarian law, because the fact of law of combats happening in Palestine or in Afghanistan and Iraq, if this has to do with this kind of prejudice, racism, etc.
Coming from Africa and having lived here for 12 years, I've seen many people very happy giving money to Amnesty International or Oxfam to feel good, but the same people are shareholders in multinationals that are abusing human rights in poor countries. My question is, does globalization enhance human rights or blocks them? That's my question.
By your account, are human rights in danger of colonizing the whole of our moral life?
Okay, should we take all three? I'll take them from the perspective of this lecture, if I may, just to carry through the argument I was putting, and that'll lead me nicely into the third one. Commission of Human Rights, there is really an imbalance between the various branches of the world order in human rights, let's face it. The Commission function has never functioned properly. The effect of its collapse in authority has been to deprive the international community of a proper, established, prestigious vehicle for the articulation of human rights norms. It is a very good example in the past, and has been, won't name any countries, of human rights being captured by the people who do the cruelty and the humiliation and the repression and so on and so forth. Insofar as I've understood them, the effort to try and re-energize the United Nations generally, and the Commission for Human Rights in particular, was a fantastic effort which should be encouraged. We've got Louise Arbour coming to the centre, if I can put a plug in February, the current UN Commissioner for Human Rights. And of course, what was done was an attempt to bypass the structural flaws. We put in a Commissioner for Human Rights, and that post has been held by excellent people. Great work needs to be done, obviously, and we need to confront the problems with that commission. And whether other countries agree with us that we don't like is neither here nor there. Humanitarian law and human rights law is another fascinating, complex area. Humanitarian law is wonderful. The problem with humanitarian law, which has driven people into the language of human rights, which relates a bit to the third question, actually, to which I'll come, is that it doesn't have an effective enforcement mechanism, so far as one can tell. I'm not an expert in this. Chris certainly is. But when you see, say, that trial and courts martial collapse, I mean, one doesn't, I don't know any more of it than I read in the newspaper, but the flaws in the procedure seem to be quite bad. So there's a mismatch between the capacity of human rights law to deliver outcomes that reflect human rights and the inability of an excellent code to deliver the same sort of outcomes. So work needs to be done on trying to redress that imbalance. I'll take your question as a globalization question. Globalization, you know, it's always been with us, it's here to stay, and it does excellent work. I was at a talk in Berlin delivered by Richard Newton, a brilliant senior vice president at BP, responsible for really putting human rights on the agenda in the corporate sector. And he was able to show, I thought rather well, about how much lives flourished because of the energy supplies to them by BP. So I think sometimes in our human rights world, we forget that actually some companies aren't maybe making the pipeline just because they fancy making a pipeline. They're making a pipeline to get something somewhere in order to make money, sure, but the something that arrives is then beneficial. So we need to, I think, collapse into the assumption that kind of globalization is its enemy, that human rights actually is put up to block. But human rights as an idea is a very assertive people matter intervention in the movement of globalization. And I think once we understand that, we can see a program, not only punishing the companies that are utterly indifferent to ethical standards, but rewarding those who do. Not just driving past Exxon because we disapprove of it, but stopping somewhere else at a place we do approve. Because one of the things these corporate actors who are pushing the human rights agenda in the corporations need is arguments to be able to persuade their more cynical colleagues that this makes good business sense. So you can develop an agenda. We need to be careful before we think that the human rights goal is no business anywhere, because then, actually, we might salve our own consciences and lead a whole lot of people into further impoverishment. The last question is succinct, and you're always a bit worried about succinct questions. Normally, when people provide very long questions, you can pick the bits and pieces you want. The question about whether or not, in a sense, human rights is colonizing the whole of our moral world. I, quite recently, would have totally agreed with you. What's wrong with the word justice? I had a fascinating lunch and debate with Richard Laird, who's here, who's making a pitch for happiness. He's written a really fascinating book called Happiness. And he says, look, Connor, you know this human rights stuff, for heaven's sake, pull back. Happiness is fine. And we had a sort of clash of the Grundnorms. I basically will use the language that's available. I mean, let's say the thrust of that lecture was a pragmatic argument. And I have certain outcomes which I rehearsed. And then towards the end I said, does the human rights language work here? Why do we need it? Well, to be honest, if the words were democratic socialism, if the words were Rawlsian justice, if the words that had the same bite today as human rights were the words, I'd be out there doing them. I'd be running a centre for the study of Rawlsian justice, or a centre, if Lord Laird gets there first, the Centre for the Study and Propagation of Happiness. That'd be a very Dickensian kind of place to go to, wouldn't it? Full of dreary and dismal colleagues. But, so, though my Lord is neither dreary nor dismal. So I think I might have answered your question. I'm an intellectual opportunist.
That was the question behind the question.
I think it was.
Time for one or two more. Yes, gentleman up there, and then you.
Would you agree with the can you hear?
Yes.
Would you agree with the perspective I have is that the force of human rights is reduced by it being part of an atomized, individuated society? It's a fragment of our needs, and that it would benefit from being placed within a wider context, a more holistic context, in order to carry it forward, to promote it, to protect it, to be a vehicle. And I'm thinking particularly of the issue of civil rights and civil liberties, which is the freedom of the group and the collective, the legitimate collective, to act in protection of civil, human and other rights. That brings into question, of course, the fact that we live now in an increasingly and threateningly heterogeneous world in which the need to find mediatory frameworks between the competing interests is the critical question. Maybe that's where our attention should be directed.
at the risk of questioning everything you've said, I hope I'm not, is morality not more than just language?
Yes, one more. Lady in the back.
If the human rights community, civil society, and the courts can grasp some of the essential truths at the heart of human rights argument, why are governments so resolutely ignoring them? And I'm thinking of the British and American governments.
Right. For his final contribution, I'm going to relieve him of any further burdens for this evening. Ask on to answer those three questions.
First one, you've spot on, and about the liberal individualism and the automatism of human rights. I alluded to that with the Locke-Hobbes legacy, which sees us all as these individuals jousting with others to protect ourselves. It is really malign. The whole of my second lecture, The Crisis of Legalism, is about addressing how to make human rights work in a way which doesn't assume we are all these individuals working on our own, like so many people in dodging cars in a playground fighting each other, because we need to do that or we are very vulnerable to the Marx and Benthamite critique. So I'm with you, but consider how difficult language is here. Civil liberties stands at one level for participation in political society. At another level, it stands for the individual versus the state. How can it manage both at the same time? So there's clearing work to be done on language, even in the field of civil liberties. On the second, is morality, can it be more than language? I think I did sort of at the end allude to that. I have to be very careful here about the way in which I presented. I think the fact that we focus on language is a reflection on our limitations. And the point of the Murray poem, I hope, was to show that it's not we're not colonizing all of truth, we're just working with the tools we have to the best of our ability. On Britain and America ignoring human rights. Point one, and a great friend in New York who's Foreign Office guy and was fantastic coming here regularly until he was posted to New York, sent me this. I sent him the lecture at about 2:30 p.m. this afternoon. At about 3:05, I got this tirade from him. And I sent it back. I said, how dare you do this in the eve of my lecture? This is outrageous. But a point he made was stop going on and on and on about America, the United States, and the United Kingdom all the time. And he actually has been to places where he's watched videos of state police killing people by boiling them in water, you know. And he has, on his postings around the world, seen what he says are unbelievable abuses of human rights. So he gets aerated by remarks like mini Guantanamo here or gulags there. Now, therefore, I want to just have that little opportunity to say, let's keep a sense of proportion here. And let's not use up all the language in a way that means when some other country, which actually chooses to kill a million people, is subjected to the same terms as a place which locks 17 or 18 people up, or even 400. So we need to be careful. Having said that, the Prime Minister made a marvellous response to 7 July on the 8th of July. He went on the radio in the Today programme. He was up there in Edinburgh, wherever it was. I think it was that week, it was all the poverty history thing. He was in good mood. He hadn't seen his namesake in the Metropolitan Police yet. And he said, look, he said, you can't stop a bomb with new laws if the person's going to get in a bus and blow themselves up. And then he said, we passed the Human Rights Act. We believe in the Human Rights Act. We don't agree with lots of the decisions, but we believe in the Human Rights Act. And that's a perfectly coherent position to adopt. You can come out fighting when you think a decision is wrong, but you don't question the premise of the decision. They don't question the structure. Now, a lot of people have talked a lot about Mr. Blair's reaction to yesterday's vote in Parliament. He hasn't actually suggested the abolition of Parliament. So let's keep a sense of perspective here. And when he condemns the House of Lords decision on Belmarsh, he doesn't say the route out is the abolition of human rights. He doesn't even say, which he could do because Parliament allows it, ignore the decision. The government implements the decision by way of renewed legislation. Now, all of us are then, Shami and all of us, we're all furious about the legislation. We're all trying to get on the telly and we're saying how dreadful it is and everything. But actually, the big picture point is that the government both regards the human rights culture as deeply annoying, but it isn't yet ready to say it shouldn't exist. And that's actually quite an important distinction, which would lead me
possibly in conclusion, rather conservative remarks with which to end, to be careful of the inflation of language. Trouble with it is, if we do that, then something really serious happens. We haven't got the words left, because we've used them all up on some triviality. Well, after a hear-hear, I'll certainly stop.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think that one of the marks of an excellent lecture is the excellence of the questions it provokes. And Connor's lecture this evening has provoked a series of extremely astute and demanding questions to which he's responded with the same brilliance as went into the lecture. Deep and wide questioning of the sources and nature of authority, which human rights talk takes, as it probably has to do, for granted. And also a tentative but very original essay in answering the big question of what should stand as authority in the world that we, and even more important, our children are going to inhabit. The answer is watch this space, partly in the form of the next two lectures when they come to be printed, but also in the form of the kind of dialogue that I think this evening's lecture has initiated and indeed deserves to initiate. Next year's Hamlin lectures are to be given by Francis Jacobs, Queen's Counsel, I'm pleased to say is here tonight, who by then will be the retired Advocate General of the European Court of Justice. But before that, the Hamlin seminar will take place. That is a seminar which the Hamlin Trust organises upon the publication of the lectures in the spring following their delivery, when the when discussants take the speaker to task, and hopefully another in-depth discussion occurs. That is partly by invitation, but also open to anybody who is around and wants to attend. So please watch for that too. There now follows what Connor in his lecture described as congregational worship. that is to say, a drinks reception outside. And it remains only for me, first of all, to invite you to it, and secondly, once again, to give Connor the Trust's and your warmest thanks for an absolutely brilliant lecture. Thank you.